5 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have thoroughly enjoyed a fantastic new book called The Boys of Riverside. That title doesn't tell you much. The subtitle, however, spells out the heart and soul of this fascinating and inspiring story. A deaf football team, and a quest for glory. This was the football team at the California School for the Deaf in Riverside, California, a small school with a student body comprised entirely of deaf students. And this is the story of an uncommonly excellent football team playing a particular kind of high school football that managed to rise through the ranks in spectacular fashion in a way that had never been experienced by this particular school. And it is a story that really garnered a great deal of attention, and deservedly so. And now we can know that story even more thoroughly thanks to this new book written by Thomas Fuller, a Page One correspondent for the New York Times, who caught wind of the story of this outstanding high school team from this deaf school and took a year out of his life and career to follow them closely and then to tell the story in this wonderful book published by Doubleday. Again, the book is The Boys of Riverside, A Deaf Football Team and a Quest for Glory. Thomas Fuller, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hi, Greg. Great to be on.
I'm really excited to talk with you. Explain to our listeners the way in which all of this got underway with nothing more fancier than a simple email that you received, I believe, from the California Department of Education.
Yeah, well, exactly. So in the job that I had at the time, which was a San Francisco correspondent, I was covering wildfires and homelessness and, you know, all the ills that befall our society. And I get this email and it says, you know, well, we just want to let you know that, you know, there's a team in Southern California and they haven't been to the championships in their league for 70 years since the founding of the school, but now they're undefeated. And I don't know what it was about that story, but I just got in my car and I drove down there. I got there just in time for one of their Friday night games, and they beat the pants off their opponents. And I just told these kids, I said, you know, I love this story. They must have thought I was a little loony because, you know, I was so enthusiastic. And that's where it started. It started with an article that I wrote, and then that turned into this book. And as you mentioned, I, you know, spent a season on the sidelines with them, going to every game. And, you know, just, I mean, they were really patient because, you know, I put them through the ringer with interviews.
I don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about this, but what does it mean when someone has a job like you had as this bureau chief in San Francisco to put that on hold? I mean, what did that represent for you, kind of logistically and professionally? And how often do people in positions like that do what you did?
Well, I can't say my bosses were super happy about it. I mean, they had to find someone, you know, to replace me. You know, I guess I had to mortgage my house because you're not paid when you're, you know, doing a project like this. It was not from the paper. And so, you know, it was, well, you know, it was risky, because, I didn't know, what was going to happen. I didn't know if this team was, you know, going to actually carry through and win the championship. But you know, the main thing was that it just felt irresistible to me. I just felt like, you know, especially because, you know, this is such a difficult time that we're going through in the country on so many different levels. And this story was just a tonic for all that. I mean, the whole time I was down there, I couldn't tell you if people are Republicans or Democrats. I couldn't tell you, you know, whether they love Trump or hate Trump. It just never came up. And it was just a release valve, you know, to be there and to be writing about high school team, just a group of kids who were so remarkable, and you know, just an ordinary team in the sense of, you know, high school kids who love to play football. But then, of course, there's the added aspect, very important aspect, that they're all deaf.
Right. And before we go any further with that, I want to be sure that we clarify for our listeners, because actually, it's a theme that comes up sort of again and again. Is that this particular team, again, at the California School for the Deaf in Riverside, they were playing eight-man football. And this is apparently something that one often sees with really small schools that otherwise would probably not be able to put a full-fledged football team on the field. Tell us more about eight-man football and how it works. And then how a school like this California School for the Deaf, who they would be playing through the course of a given season.
So I wasn't familiar with it either. You know, I mean, all my life I've been, you know, watching and playing for a brief time, you know, 11-man ball. And 8-man ball is basically, you know, you've got this school, for instance, they had 50 boys who were in the high school. So that's a pretty small pool to choose from. Half of them were on the team, by the way. And so you have schools like farming communities or native communities or, you know, smaller rural schools usually. And it's not it's a very fast-paced game. You can imagine there's, you know, once you break two tackles, you know, often you're in the open field. So it's fast, it's hard, it's punishing. I mean, the you know, you have to know how to tackle. And a lot of, you know, big names have come out of eight-man ball. Josh Allen, the Buffalo Bills quarterback, played eight-man ball in a farming community in California. And it's it was a lot of fun to get to know this game, and just to see the breathlessness of it. It's kind of like football with basketball scores.
Right.
Because you're just, you know, again, you can, you know, as long as you get past two tacklers, then, you know, you might be headed to the end zone. So I ended up really enjoying this type of football.
Right. And although we're not going to get too much into the specific results of the couple of seasons you followed, the fact that you would have scores racked up of, you know, 84-10, and sometimes, you know, both teams would score a lot, but, I mean, that was very common. And this is with the sort of mercy rule that would go into effect if the margin of the one team over the other was of a certain magnitude, that then you would just start running the clock without it ever stopping, just to quicken the demise of the losing team, put them out of their mercy, even out of their misery. Even with that, this a team like this particular one that was so strong, they would rack up these enormous point totals.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the mercy rule does apply to 11-man ball as well, but I think you're right. I think it's used more, you know, in eight-man ball, because you can have these lopsided scores. And again, yeah, as you say, not to give too much away, but the Cubs, as the team is known, They were the beneficiaries of the mercy rule, if you can put it that way, or they were on the winning side of the mercy rule. And there was a game where they were on the opposite side. It's something to behold, a game that is just so fast-paced.
We're speaking with Thomas Fuller about his new book, The Boys of Riverside, A Deaf Football Team and a Quest for Gold. This is the story of the football team at the California School for the Deaf in Riverside, a small school of some 168 students. And playing what we've just been talking about, eight-man football, and achieving extraordinary success. Your book is quite a lot about football, but your book is also quite a lot about deafness, and let's call it deaf culture. Going into this, had you ever, for instance, known anybody that was deaf or in any way had any sort of insight into what it's like to navigate the world deaf? Or was this as much a learning experience for you as it will likely be for most of us reading this book?
I was very new to the deaf world. And in a sense, maybe you rightly picked up on that in the book, because I, as part of the research for this book, I dug deeply into deaf history and spoke with neurologists and linguists, many people in the deaf community, what I learned was not only about deafness scientifically and culturally, but deafness, how it relates to football. And my conclusion from that was the hearing world might have a lot to learn from the deaf, from deaf athletes and from deaf football players in particular, when it comes to executing plays and communication.
One of the things you mention is that, and we'll get into the whole matter of sign language in just a little bit, but you tell us that football has been a game with all kinds of hand gestures for quite some time, although not forever and ever. It's really that is the hand signals of referees only date back, it's believed, to 1929 in a college game. And, of course, ultimately that spread to all kinds of football. And it's really interesting to think about the hand gestures of a referee, for instance, and how those are correspond in a really intriguing way to the gestures and signals of American Sign Language.
Right, right. Well, I thought it was interesting how that came about. It was a story I didn't realize, hadn't heard before, where referees used to, just blow the whistle and then shout out, for instance, the infraction, the penalty. And it was up to people in the stands to kind of guess what they had said. And more importantly, it was up to the radio announcers to guess what had been said. And so it was the radio announcers who went up to the referees and said, hey, can we work out a different, system? Because we're trying to call this play on the radio and we're not exactly sure, what the call is. And that's where it started. So the referees started using hand signals, and then, everyone came to understand what they meant. And, this was before the era of, referees with the microphone on the field, obviously. The era of hand signals began. And as you say, hand signals are, not quite as elegant and complicated as American Sign Language, but that was a really important part of this team that I followed, that they would communicate so fluidly and so effortlessly, coach to players and players to players on the field, and it was just so fast from play to play that it really caught the hearing teams off guard.
Right. One very interesting story you tell is from one of the occasions in which this particular team from the California School for the Deaf was playing another team of deaf football players. In fact, and that happened more than once in the course of the time you were following this team. But there was a case in which, actually, come to think of it, I don't think it was a deaf opponent. It was a hearing team, but they hired some sort of deaf interpreter to be watching what the Cubs were doing, this team from Riverside, and to interpret what was going on in terms of the sign language being used. Explain what head coach Keith Adams did from that point on.
Well, so what happened was, it was a team from Malibu, and they had a sign language interpreter. They were a hearing team, but they had a sign language interpreter who was intercepting the plays. And Keith Adams realized this, and so he said, okay, we're going to have to code our sign language. So just as you would, you know, an audible from the line, you know, red 55 or, you know, whatever it is. So that the team ended up having this pretty sophisticated, you know, coded sign language, which helped them afterwards, because when they played deaf teams, they wouldn't be afraid that the other deaf team would intercept their plays or, you know, their communication in general.
And it's interesting, early in the book, you make an intriguing point about these young men and their coaches communicating to them in sign language, that that when there is this scenario, in a sense, you do not have to work to get their attention the way that almost always it would happen when you have a bunch of athletes in a crowded room and, you know, listen up, guys. You write, communicating in sign language required unbroken eye contact. It demanded that a listener watch not only the hands, but also the slightest nuances of facial expressions. When Keith Adams, that's the head coach, reminded his players, as he did so often, that the team would succeed only if everyone did their job, all eyes were on him. Most days, Adams did not need to ask for his players' attention. It was ingrained in deaf culture. The boys were by necessity locked in. That must have been a really sort of exciting thing for you to sort of witness for the first time.
It was an exciting thing. I mean, there were so many things that I noticed that I found really fascinating. One was, for instance, the gym where the players worked out was separated from the hallway by some windows and some pretty thick doors. And for me, I would, you know, have to sort of pound on the door, try, you know, get someone to open it, hope that they, you know, see me waving my hands. For the deaf players and coaches, it didn't matter. You could be on the other side of a window, and you could communicate beautifully. And so it was, and the window versus door, you know, is sort of a symbol of deaf culture and art. And seeing them communicate, for instance, my son is on he's hearing, he's on a high school football team, and in between every play, the quarterback, and I'm sure many people are familiar with this, runs to the sidelines, talks to the coach, gets the play, runs back out to the huddle, and then communicates it to the team. Well, the Cubs would end a play and then just go back to their positions, look over at the coach, get the next play, and boom, off they went. So it really had a beauty to it, a fluidity to it. And there was, as a matter of fact, there was one coach that I spoke to who played the Cubs and who got beaten very badly. And he said, I said, what would be your advice to teams that are going to play the Cubs, you know, as they continue their playoff run? And he said, my advice would be very simple. Be very careful in thinking that you have an advantage playing a deaf team, because this team communicated better than any team I've ever played.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. We do have also the interesting insight of certain players and the head coach, for that matter, Keith Adams, of some of them having had the experience of playing on hearing teams, that is, playing with peers who were hearing. And what a different experience that was. And in almost every case, a very difficult, sometimes an even heartbreaking experience in which it was all but impossible for them to be a fully functioning part of the team. I mean, once in a while, but I suppose it would really take exceptional teammates or maybe sensitive coaches or whatever in order for a deaf player to, in a sense, fully belong. And so for players like that, having had that experience, it was an incredible joy for them to be on a team in which everyone was deaf, and in a sense, the whole culture was deaf, and they could be fully functioning, fully participating. I think that's a distinction maybe a lot of us wouldn't stop to fully consider.
I think that's precisely right, that there was this sense that most of these players had encountered barriers when they were they loved football. And as kids, they played, you know, in Pop Warner leagues. But it was such a frustrating experience because they're great athletes, but they just couldn't be in a huddle and understand what the play was. They couldn't communicate. And then they join this all-deaf team, and they shine, and they win so convincingly. It was something that really convinced me of the importance in sports of a brotherhood.
Right.
If you have a brotherhood, if you have a connection with other players, that goes such a long way.
And that was especially powerful in this case. It reminds me of a story you tell about one of these players, a young man by the name of Dominic Turner, who you tell us underwent cochlear implant. And this was a procedure that had the potential, at least, of somewhat restoring the sense of hearing, although you explain that someone who has one of these implants typically is not hearing the way the rest of us hear. But there is something there that at least somewhat resembles the sense of hearing. It's so interesting, you tell us, about the choice, the willing choice that Dominic Turner would make when it came to this implant and whether or not to use it. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
So this intersection of technology and deaf culture was fascinating. So Dominic, when he was 5 years old, got this implant that's basically a bionic ear. It was invented a few decades ago, and it's become a very important part, a very popular technology for older people who might lose their hearing, for anyone who might lose their hearing, and for young deaf children who have them implanted so that they can obtain a measure of hearing. So Dominic had these implants when he was 5 years old, but he also knew sign language very well. And he, fluently, that was his first language. And so he had the choice in life, and I found this fascinating. He could wake up in the morning and say, today I will be hearing, and he would put in the implant. Or he could say, today I don't want to hear anything. I want to be deaf. And often, as you referenced, he would choose to be deaf because his language, the language that he was most comfortable in, was sign language. I don't think we can really understand that choice and that the idea that, for instance, Dominic, when he went to the beach, he said, well, I like to put in my implants when I'm at the beach because I like the sound of the waves. I like to put it in when I go see a movie because I want to hear the movie. But if I'm walking down the street and there's a lot of noise around me, there's traffic and other noises, then I'd rather not have it in because why listen to all that noise?
So interesting. Well, speaking of sign language, we learn a lot about that in and of itself in your fascinating book, particularly in a chapter called Frowned Upon by the Gods, in which you really kind of sketch to us kind of the history of the deaf finding their way in the world and the way in which they would be regarded throughout history and all around the world as well. I mean, I'm really impressed by all that you talk about in this chapter. But one of the things you explore that's especially interesting is the work of a Frenchman, Charles-Michel de Lepy, who served in the court of Louis the 14th, if I'm reading my Roman numerals correctly. Yes, in the early 18th century. So this is a long time ago, but the interest he took in the deaf community in Paris ended up making a gigantic difference, at least for a while, in terms of the way the deaf were regarded and the opportunities they were given. Just briefly explain what we are talking about in terms of this important breakthrough.
So de Lepy was an abbot, a Catholic abbot, who was somewhat of an outsider in the church for various reasons, and so understood what it meant to be an outsider. And there's a slightly apocryphal, we don't know, the details of the story, about him meeting a deaf family and seeing them signing to each other and him realizing that he wanted to understand this more, that he wanted to learn the language, and that he wanted to cultivate, help these young deaf signers in this kind of organic sign language. And so de Lepy was instrumental in founding what became the world's first, as far as we know, public school for the deaf. And French sign language was codified from that. And students through sign language were able to learn how to read and write, which is obviously crucial for communication over generations of deaf people. And then, of course, the footnote to the story is that one of de Lepy's acolytes came to America and helped found a deaf school in Hartford and ultimately Gallaudet University, the premier university in America for deaf students. And he also helped codify what is now American Sign Language. And for that reason, American Sign Language and French Sign Language are very closely related. About half of the signs have the same root, which is fascinating because English Sign Language, British Sign Language, and American Sign Language are very, very different. So it just shows the how history can sort of wind in very curious ways.
Absolutely. And you mentioned, by the way, something I find so interesting, that basically American Sign Language and British Sign Language are so different that they are essentially unintelligible one to the other. I mean, it would be as though two people speaking two unrelated languages being unable to communicate. It's such a fascinating thing to think about. And you also trace a really interesting history of how at certain periods in time, sign language was regarded as a sort of a shameful concession and would be banned in certain settings. And these deaf students would be forced to lip read and attempt to speak as we speak. And I mean, thankfully now we don't see that. We see a full embrace of sign language and its complexity and sophistication as a full-fledged language of its own accord. Two more quick questions. Thank you so much. I'm speaking with Thomas Fuller, the author of The Boys of Riverside. The timing of this story is interesting in that it essentially begins in 2021 as the world is emerging from the worst of the COVID pandemic. You tell us that that was a very difficult period for people in the deaf community as well. I mean, all of us felt isolation of one kind or another, but this was particularly true. And I appreciate you writing about that. But you also write about, kind of within that context, the gigantic difference that technology in general has made for the deaf community in recent years. Just say a quick word about the most significant ways in which the lives of the deaf have been changed for the better because of technology.
Absolutely. You know, I thought about the launch of the iPhone. Was it in 2010 that rings a bell?
A little earlier than that, but yeah, 2007, okay. I think, yeah.
Oh, okay. And, you know, Steve Jobs in California saying, look at this, look at this new phone. And it was, you know, as we know, we all have these, you know, supercomputers in our pockets, and it was a revolution. But for the deaf community, it was an enormous revolution. I mean, I communicate over text message with all of the players as if there were no, you know, language barrier at all. The deaf players would FaceTime with each other and work out their plays, you know, signing to each other. Classrooms have, in the deaf school, have screens where, you know, you call the teacher four classrooms down and you sign your message. And so it's been the smartphone in particular, but just technology in general, Zoom calls, any type of video communication has really made what were barriers to deaf kids. For instance, there's a coach on the Cubs who grew up in the 1950s, and the summers for him were the worst time of year because he wasn't with his deaf friends at school any longer. He was isolated at home, and he couldn't use the telephone and call them. They lived far away from him. All of that has changed with technology.
Right. You call that, that's the story of Ken Watson, and you said for him, summer was the season of loneliness. And then, of course, for him to be able to return to his community, meant all the difference in the world. I find myself also wondering, through the course of following this team, to what extent were you able to connect with them in the way that you would have probably connected with a team in which you could have spoken freely and easily? I mean, you've already talked about how through texting and so on, you still were able, of course, to communicate with them. But what kind of difference do you think it means in terms of how close a personal connection you established with both these coaches and with these football players?
Well, I learned very quickly that American Sign Language is a very complex, sophisticated language, and that if I wanted to get the 100% accuracy and understanding that I needed in telling this story, that I would need an interpreter by my side all the time. And that's what I had. I had the defensive coordinator's daughter who is a college student, was my interpreter. She is terrific. You know, the difference between English and American Sign Language is vast, vast. I mean, they are not, they are connected, these languages, but very tenuously. And so as to, you know, the connections that I made with the coaches and the players, it came from sitting down for hours and hours and hours in these interpreted conversations and standing on the side of the field for every practice and having, you know, my interpreter, Malika Angarani, just, you know, in my ear the whole time, this person just said this, this person just said that. So it was, you know, it was an exercise. It was as if I, you know, were, I mean, I used to be the Southeast Asia correspondent for the New York Times. I am very familiar with, you know, the idea of going to Cambodia or Burma or, you know, and needing an interpreter to understand everything I'm seeing. It was very similar to that.
Wow. Well, we're so glad that you take us on this extraordinary journey with this football team. And as along the way, we meet some really striking individuals, including the head coach's gifted son, the quarterback, and other players on the team, one of whom, very gifted athlete, who is homeless, who essentially sleeps in his dad's car in the parking lot of Target, to other students who have had various experiences and demonstrated such resilience. And it's an amazing story with an amazing end, but we're not going to give that away. We leave it to our listeners to explore your book to see if this team from Riverside, California, is able to achieve their long-sought-for championship. But however it ends up, it's a remarkable journey indeed. Told beautifully in your book, The Boys of Riverside, A Deaf Football Team and a Quest for Glory, published by Doubleday, the author, Thomas Fuller. Thomas Fuller, congratulations on writing a fantastic book. And thank you for being my morning show guest today. Best wishes,
Greg, Steve. Thank you very much. Those were very incisive and perceptive questions. Thank you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And I'm excited to be able to spend the next few minutes with Christina Sauer, who is an associate editor for National Geographic Kids Books. She's done a lot of editing for them, and one of her most recent projects is a wonderful book called Why the Human Body? 99 Plus Awesome Answers for Curious Kids, which explores all kinds of facets of the human body and what makes it such a wondrous thing. And it especially explores things that we tend to really take for granted and answers all kinds of questions that might not occur to those of us who are adults, but do pop into the minds of inquisitive of kids of all ages. And Christina Sauer joins us for the next few minutes to talk about this book and some of the other work she's done for National Geographic. Christina Sauer, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much, Greg. I'm so happy to be here.
So tell us how you found your way professionally to this particular post with National Geographic and what you find especially satisfying about it.
Yeah, so I will say my story started a long time ago when I was a kid. I was a very curious kid, but my love of science kind of came from an event that happened. So my sister is a brain cancer survivor, and it was actually due not to genetics, but to our environment. And as a kid, I didn't understand what was happening, and many adults couldn't explain what was going on that was causing people to get sick, and I felt really powerless. And I decided right then and there that I was going to make sure that I was never not understanding the world around me. But more than that, I wanted to make sure other kids never felt this way either. So that led me on a long journey. You go to school for the sciences, to also do on the side theater and writing. And I loved reading books my entire life. And I always thought, oh, that would be something fun to do. And it turns out it was a job. So I've worked in various places. From I got a chance to work with NASA on the Hubble Space Telescope. I've worked with Disney Junior creating shows like Eureka about little girl inventors. And now I'm here, which is probably one of the most rewarding careers where I get to make books about the things that I know kids are asking questions and wanting to know more about, and handing them this book and empowering them in a way that I didn't have necessarily when I was a kid.
So tell us about the challenge of writing about scientific matters for young readers and the kind of things you think about in terms of, for instance, keeping the material simple and yet not so simple that it sort of feels like a baby book, or so simple that it doesn't say very much. I mean, I should think it's maybe a stiffer challenge than some of the rest of us stop to realize.
It's true. Honestly, if you can explain something to a child, you can explain it to anyone, because kids are the ones who are going to ask you some of the toughest questions and want to keep asking the reason why it's named this book, why? Why is that? And you have to really understand the very nuances of a subject. But this book, I would say, is not made just by me. It's a huge team who works together to make sure that this is the right voice, tone, language, scientific information, and accuracy for that child. So for me, my job is overseeing all of it. So I'll get the manuscript from our fabulous writer, Paige Towler, who works not only with a fact checker to make sure everything's correct, but we actually talk to our Nat Geo explorers. There's one who's a neuroscientist and another who's a human biologist who's featured in the book, who really look at the facts and go, okay, this is the research I'm doing, making sure it's up to date, and also explaining it in a very simple way, but not shying away from those big words. I mean, I use as an example, we ask the question, like, why can't I live forever? And we talk about chromosomes and what we know today, and that the telomeres, that they shorten, and we think that that's why we are aging, and that it's related to that process. So we're not afraid to say, hey, there's this word called the chromosome, and we're going to contextualize it so that when you get into, you know, genetics or biology later in life as a high school student, you've already been introduced to it. So we do. We have leading experts to make sure it's at the level. But also our writers are really great about making it very conversational. When you read this book, if you read it aloud, it kind of sounds like someone talking to you, like your best friend.
And it's interesting. I don't think I'd really stop to think about it, but why is really one of the favorite questions of young children. And when you think about it, why is a lot harder question to answer, generally speaking, than, for instance, what is that, or who is that, or where are we? But why, why is this thing true? Why does this have to be this way? That's a tough question. I mean, no matter who's asking it. And I bet that for you and your writers, it's not always the easiest question to answer.
It really isn't, but it is actually the probably one of the most fun questions to answer, because it kind of challenges us. It forces us to go out there and see what's out there. And some of the questions that are in the book will feel so kid relatable, like, why do I throw up? Or why do I breathe? Why does music make my body move? Why does a mosquito bite me? But the funny thing is, you may think, oh, these are kids' questions. But the truth is that each of these questions are things and questions that scientists are asking every day as they do research. And that's another thing that informs the text, is there's the scientists out there who are actively working on it. And we're not afraid to say, hey, we don't have an answer to it. And the scientists don't have an answer to it anymore, or yet, but they're going to. So things like, can I freeze myself, or can I upload my brain to a computer? We say, we don't know yet. We can't do it right now, but here's who's working on it and how.
So explain to our listeners how this book is laid out and what kind of thought went into just organizing it.
Yeah, so I would say you don't have to read this book cover to cover. It is not one of those that you need to stick to page one and then read all the way to page 200. You can pick which questions you really want to get to know and then read the others afterwards. We laid it out in an order that starts with anatomy. So I always recommend read that chapter first, because it kind of sets up an introduction to the body, especially for kids as young as six who may not know all these things, like don't understand how your lungs work or your digestive system works, before we get into the really specific questions. Then after that, it's a free-for-all. So we have things on like the senses and hearing and smell. We have questions about genetics, like why do I like spicy foods or why don't I like cilantro? Turns out it's genetically related. And then we go into the brain and talking about like what's the brain made of? How do you have things that go on in your brain? We go into gross stuff. Like we also talk about animals a lot too. What are the grossest animals on the planet? Why do I have bad breath? Or why do people, you know, have pus? Like, it's all the nasty, stuff that kids sometimes are afraid to ask, and as adults, we're like, we don't want to talk about it. We give you the answer. And then we go into the future. So, like, where we're at with science now related to the body and where we think we'll be in the future.
Mm.
Like,
I love the way that allows us to explore so many different facets of the human body, and with a really fun sort of attitude, which will, I think, speak to readers of all ages, probably, but especially young people. Let me give you just a few moments to talk about one or two of the most interesting facts that people might find surprising in your book.
Absolutely. So if we're going to start at the beginning, we'll talk about your anatomy and your blood. This is a question I remember as a kid was really important to me. I would look at my body and I would see that I had veins and arteries that looked blue or green. And I would always think, well, then that means my blood's blue or green, right? And then you would get a cut or a scrape and you had red blood. And I was like, that makes no sense. Why isn't there blue or green? So we go into why is my blood red? And we talk about the fact that in your blood, there are red blood cells, and they carry oxygen through your body. And the way they do that is from a protein called hemoglobin. And hemoglobin just happens to be colored red, and so your blood is red. But we're one of the majority of species that have red blood, but actually not all species have red blood. There are a couple of octopuses and spiders that have blue blood. So that's a whole other story, and that's one of those facts that we like throw out there. And then be like, okay, kids, there's a picture here. Go look it up. Go see if you can find out why they have blue blood and we don't.
The book, again, is Why the Human Body, 99-plus awesome answers for curious kids. And it comes from National Geographic and its editor, Christina Sauer. Christina Sauer, thank you so much for giving the world this wonderful book. And best wishes to you and all of your colleagues at National Geographic.
Thank you so much, Greg, and thank you for having us. We're always happy to talk about our book.
Take care. Monday on the morning show, I look forward to welcoming back into our studios Dr. Jerry Mast, professor of political science at Carthage College. We'll be speaking with him just as the Democratic National Convention is getting underway, just as we spoke to him just ahead of the Republican National Convention beginning. And of course, since Professor Mast's most recent visit to the program, a lot has changed. Including, of course, the decision of President Joe Biden to step down from this upcoming presidential race and for Vice President Kamala Harris to become the Democratic nominee, presumptive nominee. We'll talk with him about all of that, Kamala Harris's selection for a vice presidential running mate, and what is likely ahead over the next weeks and months. Next week, by the way, is also going to include our next visit from Art Sear, who joins us on a monthly basis. His visit next week will be at the Thursday morning show. By the way, tomorrow on the podcast version of the morning show, from way back in 2000, a conversation with Mike Schumacher talking about his biography of filmmaker Francis Ford Coppola. Today's going to be partly sunny, very warm and humid, with a 50% chance of afternoon rain. Today's high, 83 degrees. Cloudy and warm overnight. More rain is likely tonight. Low of 65 and a 60% chance of still more rain tomorrow as well with a high of 79. Sunshine by Sunday and sunny skies and comfortable temperatures expected for most of next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.